your town may be big or small, you may be a different form of government, but we are still doing all the same things for best practices. And no matter where you live, people are people and they want to recreate. And I think for me that I would encourage young professionals or professionals, no matter where they are in their career, they should always be raising their personal bar, because once you raise your personal bar, the standards for your professional world automatically change.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Becky Talks Parks, a podcast for parks and recreation professionals who are passionate about raising the bar in the field. Today, I've got another great interview for you. I'm talking to Melissa Petit, who is the director at Lexington Recreation and Community Programs. I think you're really going to like this episode for a couple reasons. Melissa has worked her way up in the field. It's so interesting to hear about her beginnings as a playground supervisor compared to where she is today. This is helpful to understand because patience is super important when you're embarking on this career path. The other reason why I think you'll like this interview is that Melissa is passionate about therapeutic recreation, and she was able to create a thriving program in Brookline, Massachusetts from scratch. She has a ton of wisdom to share, and she shared it all in this episode, so I hope that you enjoy it. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm so pleased to be talking with Melissa Petit. Melissa and I actually met back in 2015 at the NRPA conference in Las Vegas. We both signed up for the mentorship program, and me being the mentee and Melissa being the mentor, she was the assistant director at Brookline in Massachusetts, and I was still working part-time in recreation in Boulder. And so when we met, it was such a great opportunity for me to ask a ton of questions and understand what her role entailed and to just get some career advice. And it's funny because those kinds of conversations are what inspired me to actually start this podcast, because I realized that it takes a lot of work. You have to sign up for those programs and know who to talk to. But I believe that the information and the advice that Melissa and other professionals are giving are really so critical to young professionals and students understanding what their career might look like. And so it's exciting that I'm kind of making this full circle and talking to Melissa today about some of the decisions that she made, how she got to where she is today, talking about therapeutic recreation. And so with all those things in mind, I'm just so pleased to be talking with Melissa today.
Sure. Thanks, Becky. And that program with NRPA has been really a great opportunity. I've been doing it for many years, and it's sometimes it's take a student to lunch, or it's, you know, you might want to meet with somebody from another part of the country at a different level in their career. So I have gotten as much out of those lunch engagements at NRPA as you did and some of the other professionals I've met throughout the years. So I would encourage you to continue to do that. I would say that my journey, or how I first came into the field of parks and recreation, was a bit non-traditional, but when I look back, especially the longer I'm in the field, it definitely makes sense. So as many young adults in high school and college, every summer I spent as a playground supervisor, and that was before camps and everything was super organized. So I would show up at the local playground under the recreation department with a bag of tricks and supplies and arts and crafts and sports things, and spend the morning and afternoon with whomever showed up, and go home every afternoon for lunch. And it was great. It was perfect. We were outside, you know, playing with kids. Not a lot of super big responsibility in terms of the things that we do now for running summer programs. But I always would be involved in park and rec myself, but didn't realize what a park and rec department really was when I was participating or being employed by them. And when I went off to college, I went to Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven, Connecticut. I wasn't really sure what my major was going to be, and I think it was second semester freshman year, for one of my electives, I took Intro to Recreation, and my professor was great, and you started to learn, and I was really exposed to, really, recreation isn't just about having fun and playing sports. We talked about playgrounds and parks and the system and where it fits in government and private and nonprofit and public. So it really piqued an interest with me, so that the next semester I took travel and tourism. And I took another two more courses, I think, because I really hadn't claimed what my major was going to be. So I, you know, took some more electives, some classes that would meet the requirements for whatever major I would go to. And I was so fortunate enough that the staff there were really fantastic. And in particular, you may know or have heard of Dr. Ellen O'Sullivan, who has been an advocate in the park and recreation and health field for decades. And she was my counselor at Southern. And she really guided me and helped me better understand what a career in park and recreation would be. And so by the end of sophomore year, I then decided to claim my major as recreation and leisure studies. And of course, at that time, you know, my mother said, well, what the heck are you going to do with that? You know, so as I was learning about what the major would be and what my career would look like, you know, I think it's something we're still doing to this day is really justifying what we do and helping people understand what we do and the importance of it, because it's not as clear cut as public safety or education or healthcare, things like that. But all of our roles play a huge part in public safety and healthcare and all of that. So I would say that, you know, I finished school, I did my internships, and I had some great placements. They were both very, very different. And I was out of school probably about 9 months, 8 or 9 months. And, you know, I was still looking to land my first full-time job. And my guidance counselor from Southern, Dr. Ellen O'Sullivan, contacted me and said, hey, listen, there's a job opportunity up in Brookline, Massachusetts. It's a 1 year temporary position. Somebody's going out on leave. Why don't you just go update your resume, go on the interview? And so that's what I did. I was 22 years old, right out of college, and I came up and they offered me the job. And I said, you know what? What the heck? I can do anything for a year. It'd be great experience for my resume. And I moved up to Boston and I took the 1 year position, and I ended up staying in Brookline for 23 years. And that, I think, really was what changed my whole path really on life and my career, because I moved to Boston. I ended up staying in the area, starting my family, raising my family here. And I was fortunate enough to be in a department like Brookline Mass that has historically been a leader in the park industry, in trends, in facilities. We had the first indoor swimming pool in the United States. We had one of the first public playgrounds. Much of our park system is part of the Emerald Necklace and the Olmsted program. So I was really exposed to quite a bit in that first, my first job. And luckily for me, it was a department that had many, many employees who were aging out and preparing for retirement. So over the course of the 23 years, I came in as a frontline rec leader, and I moved up to recreation supervisor one, recreation supervisor two, and then assistant director, where I was for the almost 9 years prior to me leaving Brookline. And so I would say that that's where my journey was, and I loved it there. And about a year and a half ago, this opportunity in Lexington came to be. And similar to most states, we have a very strong state association and a network of colleagues where we get together about work-related things. We stay in touch by phone, via email. We have monthly meetings. We have, of course, our annual conference. And with that, you become friends, and you talk about work and non-work things. And this position here in Lexington, we knew was going to be opening up. And, you know, a mentor to me who was in this position started talking to me about it. And I really wasn't interested in leaving Brookline. I had, you know, I was very comfortable. I was very challenged. I loved what I did and who I worked with. And but I looked at this opportunity the same way. I sort of had to take a step back before saying, no, I don't. Why do I want a big life change at this point in my career? Is, you know, I looked at it the same way as when I made that decision to move here when I was 22 and said, you know, if I don't take this opportunity to just try, I'll never know. And, you know, what about in a year if this opportunity, another opportunity is not available? So So I did the same thing. I heard some of my mentors' voices in my ears whispering, and I talked to some friends and family and said, why not? You know, and I think we should often say that to ourselves professionally and personally, like, why not try? What's the worst can happen? They say no. So I went through the process, and it was a little over just about 3 month process. And here I am. I was offered the position for Director of Recreation and Community Programs, and January was a year that I've been here in Lexington, and I'm thrilled. It's very similar to Brookline in terms of its demographics and socioeconomic and the way the community values park and recreation and what they invest in it. So I'm very fortunate to have this opportunity and a department of staff that are fantastic. So we've been able to do a lot of great stuff in the short time I've been here.
Melissa, it sounds like you've been able to create a really powerful impact in your community already in that short time. Can you talk to us about what you do on a day-to-day basis as a director for recreation and community programs?
This is one of the things that I love about our industry, regardless of where you are in the organizational chart, is that every day is different, and that we have this built-in flexibility to continue to reinvent ourselves no matter which position we're in, versus always having to reinvent ourselves in going into a new position. And I think that's something that's really important, is to always self-assess what you're doing and to make sure you're happy going to work every day. You know, we are open when, you know, people are at work and at school. We're open when they get out of work and out of school, nights and weekends, holidays. And, you know, so sometimes it might feel inconvenient, these night meetings or, you know, these events, but the built-in flexibility and the opportunities and the rewards that we get out of it is so worth it. So, you know, when you come to work as the director here, you've got your administrative role. You've got your normal kind of email communication, staff support, staff development, kind of program development, but you're always focusing on the big picture. And so I often will make sure I, at the end of every week, review our department goals and my professional goals to make sure that what we're working towards is going to get us there rather than just making the day-to-day decisions. And so I spend a lot of time here in Lexington doing some community work. There's close to 100 boards and committees in Lexington for a population of 32,000. So there's a lot of public process that engage through financial committees, our recreation committees. We've got subcommittees for programming, and that's true of all the different departments. We spend a lot of time working with the other senior managers to make sure that all of the departments are aware of each other's goals and priorities and townwide initiatives that we need to be aware of in our day-to-day operation. I spend a lot of time supervising, just checking in, and not supervising, you know, in terms of managing anything in particular, but making sure I'm visiting the locations, whether it's stopping by the golf course a few times a week, even if it's raining, or going by the swimming pool, checking out the ping pong program at the community center, stopping by that playground where we know we've had a few incidents, good or bad, or, you know, we're parents where we know people are congregating, and really just making yourself present. And I found that was something I've had to be very conscious of here after leaving a community that I was in for over 20 years, where I didn't have to do that. I knew everybody that was, you know, a large majority of the community, and they knew me. And here it's really, I have to work in towards developing those relationships and creating those partnerships. And that part of it's been really exciting because people are so thrilled to hear about all the things that we're doing, whether it's a renovation or if it's we have a new logo, whether it's updating our webpage. There's just so many different things that you can jump into on any given day.
I think it's great that you've been able to reach out to your community and build relationships. And I know that presence at a park is especially important for frontline staff to see a director come into their park is really, really powerful. I know that one thing that you're passionate about is inclusion, but before we start down the path, and I'm really interested about your therapeutic recreation programs, but can you define what inclusion means to you I think we all have slightly different definitions.
You know, I think that it means quite a few things to me, but in the broader sense, or within our industry, I guess I should say, you know, inclusion, for the most part, people will think about adaptive or inclusive for all ages and abilities. And that certainly is a large majority of it. In terms of what inclusion means to me, I like to look at it a little bit broader. And of course, it's all ages and all abilities, but it also is, can they get here? Are we hosting and offering our programs in a place that are easy for them to access via walking, biking, or public transportation? Or do we have adequate parking? Is the program affordable? Inclusion means being affordable for all, whether they can, you know, get into the program or we waive that fee, but can they also then get all of the equipment? Of the inclusion means that, you know, we are open during times when we know that, you know, the people who are interested need to come at a different day. So it's really understanding your community and what inclusion means in your particular community. I would say that I first was exposed to some differences in sort of community members. It goes back to one of my high school experiences when I worked in a camp, and I worked with a population of young boys who are at risk. And, you know, by the end of the summer, they look at you as a best friend. And some of the things I was not aware with, you know, you hear on the news were really happening in some of these children's lives. And so that's when equity and the financial piece became really important to me. And then later, when I came up to Brookline and I became a little more involved with Special Olympics as a volunteer myself, we didn't have them in Brookline, and we didn't really have a strong program that was adaptive, and we didn't feel confident that we could provide a successful program to all ages and abilities. So at that time, we made that a goal, and it was one of those, what comes first. We knew that there was the need, but we couldn't justify it because people weren't turning to us for those services. And so we did a lot of grassroots with parents and the school district and starting up different programs and doing outreach to let people know we were available. And after about 8 years, we had enough momentum going that the community asked for a full-time CTRS, and we were able to get that funded through tax dollars. And now it's a thriving year-round therapeutic rec division with, I think it's 1.5 staff members. We've got over 150 volunteers. We've got summer programming, trips. We've got two or three sports and Special Olympics every season. So it was really fantastic to watch something like that grow. And, the rewarding part of that is that no matter how long it took or how difficult some of the challenges may have been to train your staff or, you know, build the confidence with the community and the school district and the budgeting for it, is that when you see the reward on the athletes or the participant or those parents who just are so thrilled that they had a Friday night dinner of respite because we took their kids on a trip, and or the, you know, after 3 years, their son made a basketball, scored a three-pointer after three seasons. I mean, those are the kinds of things that really keep me fired up and excited about what we're doing every day, because that's what we do, whether it's inclusion or not, is that we're, you know, we're making changes, positive changes in people's lives. And you never know when that one thing is going to change someone's lives way more than you ever anticipated.
Do you mind sharing a few more stories that you have from your career that demonstrate the power that therapeutic recreation can have on the community and on your organization?
Oh, there's been so many. I mean, especially over the years of developing the Brookline program, it was, you know, it's just, you know, could take your breath away and brings tears to your eyes. But it's really watching the friendships that come out of that, whether it's the parents who now have found new friends that they can lean on who are experiencing the same types of struggles or, you know, successes that they are, watching the participants, especially the high school and the young adults, where they have very limited social opportunities compared to their peers at that age. And so watching them create and develop these friendships that are just so typical. And then they would now see each other outside of our organized program and really start to develop typical friendships of a a 22 or a 23-year-old. And I think one of the best pieces that we've done, and we've done this now here in Lexington prior to me even coming, is that we've onboarded some of our young adults to be part of our team. They're now part of our staff, whether they're working at customer service, whether they're part of our facilities and maintenance, whether they're checking in at a large event. And they really are part of who we are. And what I've learned is that our staff and our typical participants are gaining more out of those experiences than that one person who we're providing a 10-hour a week job for. And I think that is part of what inclusion is. It's awareness, and it's, you know, they have differences, but they're not different. They like to be around people and would like a job. And we've learned just as much from them as they've learned from us providing this job opportunity.
That sounds like such an incredible program, because you watch the people who were once in your classes develop into professionals that you want to hire and employ and work with every day. So I love that story. Can you give us some advice for those listening who might be interested in developing a therapeutic recreation program? Like, what's involved with that? What are some examples and stories that you have from developing your own recreation program or therapeutic recreation program in Brookline? Because I'm sure that process is something that a lot of people are interested in.
I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing here in Lexington. We had, when I came a year plus ago, we have probably 3 to 5 adaptive specific programs, and it was adaptive tennis lessons, swim lessons, and basketball. Those were the 3 big programs. And outside of that, there wasn't anything that was truly marketed to be inclusive, and we didn't really have a large attendance in any of those adaptive programs. So one of the things that we've done in the last year is really identify those other service providers in town that are already offering therapeutic programming or already have the infrastructure within either their facility physically or within their org chart for professionals who are trained, or they might have the supplies. And we've brought them together and we've talked about different things. So we've brought some of those programs into our facilities to offer, and then we co-market those programs so that we're not fighting for the same resources, the same population, the same days and times. If someone's already doing a music program, let us support that and make that resource available. And as we've done that, more and more families are now coming into our community center. They may be taking a music class with one of our partners, but at least now they're in the rec center and they're learning about us. And they're going to see that we now have a drop-in billiard program, or they can do ping pong, or they can sit on the computer, or they can just bring their lunch on a Saturday and sit here with friends. And so some of that is the grassroots. We've made some specific steps towards developing a partnership with the special education department to understand what the need in the school system is in terms of, you know, what are parents asking them to do outside of school? Where are they seeing that they might be able to assist us with that, with staff training or making suggestions around some adaptive equipment to make some of our existing programs more accessible? So doing things like that has helped significantly. We've met with some parent groups, and we get so much information from them. We've got families that are paying a lot of money to go to other towns for the services that we hope to then provide. So, you know, it's one of those, it's a small movement because you want to make sure it's successful. It's not something we can just open up the doors. We have to be very thoughtful about it and make sure that we have the proper staff in place. But we're really excited about the coming year. We have a part-time CTRS funded in our FY19 budget for 12 hours a week year round. And in this first year, we'll focus specifically on doing the needs of what we have that could be adaptive, the sort of deficiency areas, working with the parents to do some surveys around what kind of programming they'd like to see. So it's not as easy as creating like an event that we're used to and saying, hey, we're going to do an outdoor movie series, or we're going to add a couple extra sections of this program. This is a little bit slower in terms of the growth, but it is more successful doing it that way so far. That's what we've learned.
I think those are some really powerful insights for those of you out there who are looking to start your own therapeutic recreation program. I know one thing that you've done is actually created a partnership where you've worked with the mental health organization that you had in your local community, and then the Parks and Recreation Department and the school district. Can you talk about what problem you were solving and some of the steps that you took to get to the final solution?
In Brookline, we created a really fantastic summer partnership where we had our 3-day camps, and the school department had their extended school year programs for children. And what we found was that there were families that were choosing to send their children to a full day program and not send their child to the extended school year because of childcare purposes. And then there were other families who chose the extended school year, but then didn't have any options for the rest of the day if they were going, needed to go to work, or they wanted their children, their students to have, you know, some socialization, not to just be in school all morning and then that was their summer. So we worked with the school district and we created some campuses, 3 campuses where the school district offered their extended school year programming in the same buildings where we offered our camp. So we had a seamless transition. When the school year programs ended midday, those students would join us for lunch. And then in the afternoon, they would join the groups during in the summer day camp. And so we would have anywhere from 75 to 120, depending on the week and the summer, join us in the afternoon. So it was almost as if it was a camp within a camp. And this provided such relief to families around needing full day childcare or having siblings that, you know, one child was only covered till noon and the other children could stay till 4. It provided social opportunities. It went on and on to the point where we, from having that many children join us half day, we were able to, after a handful of years, engage the school department's food service operation, where we then extended the reduced and free lunch program to our summer camps, so that the children who were on financial aid or reduced lunch during the school year, that program extended in the summer. And what we, in our demographics at that point, we had over 50% of our campers from both the schools and the, you know, a typical registrant from the town, a resident, over 50% were taking advantage of the free and reduced. And then the others who wanted to take advantage of it as a convenience would just pay the fee. And so it created jobs for the school department, for the food service. It provided some additional income to the food service program at the schools. And then the extended day program, we provided more jobs for those paraprofessionals who were interested in staying on with us in the afternoon. So we were really able to provide a full summer wraparound care, regardless of their ability to pay or their ability to participate, because we built the infrastructure with staffing and being in the same facility that we eliminated the transportation need. We just walked them from one side of the building down to where we were. And so that was a fantastic piece of it. And in addition, for that community, there was a local community mental health center that worked with really the at-risk population, these families who struggled with organizational skills. And the summer would come and they never registered for camp, or they didn't have a bathing suit, or, you know, all of the different struggles. They wouldn't have, you know, the means to make those lunches for camp. And so we partnered with the mental health center, who then placed 35 children in our camps. And that was really a huge assistance to us in terms of the overhead, because they were in the homes meeting with the families. So they were able to get all of those forms that are required by the health department for signatures and health records and permissions. And so they were able to collect that from those 35 families, where we would have been chasing them, you know, through the mail or through email. And many times before we had that partnership, those children wouldn't be able to participate unless we had the forms. So we were able to provide that as another bridge to make sure that these students were engaged in a healthy, safe program during the summer, versus the option of where some of these kids would just be home alone at a very young age with a television.
So with all those positive changes that you and your team have made in the community, and when I'm thinking about the rest of the Parks and Recreation departments around this country and how much positive impact they have, why does it feel like we always have to justify the value of Parks and Recreation?
I do think we will always be in a position to justify what we do. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because it keeps us fresh and it keeps us aware of that at all times. You know, we're in a different type of service industry where, you know, compared to some of our counterparts where they can say how many minutes it took to get to an emergency or, you know, how many lives were saved. What we do is really prevention work, and that's the hardest thing to justify. I think that the difficult part is when we are looked at as a want and not necessarily a need. But when you look at the data around communities that have, you know, lower rates of, you name it, anything A to Z, that the communities that have a strong park and recreation department have lower percentages of obesity or crime or mental health crises. I mean, so all of those things. And that's because it's part of the core services of that town or that facility and that department. So I think that people sometimes take it for granted because it's expected and we're here and we do it and we make things happen. But I don't think that our justification will necessarily ever go away. In fact, it may become more difficult over the years as we continue to, compete for the same resources, whether it's open space or facilities or staffing or fund dollars in your fund, budget funds. So, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think we just have to be smart about how we justify our work. And it's not all about successes. I mean, we have challenges, and I think it's fair to share those justifications. And I think it's important to share that if our services went away, what that would impact, and whether it's employment for summer months, whether it is, you know, health and wellness, all of those types of things. So it's our job to be proactive. I mean, that's what we do as an industry. So I think that we just need to apply that to being proactive of how we sell ourselves to those decision makers.
I love those ideas. All right, Melissa, so we have gotten to the very last question. How do you think that parks and recreation professionals can raise the bar in their organization or in the field of parks and rec?
I think raising the bar could mean something different to different professionals in different communities. You know, if you're looking to raise the bar by increased programming, increased participation, if you you want to raise the bar by growing your department in some way in the organizational chart, I often self-reflect in terms of raising the bar. And so if someone is starting to feel that their department is a little flat or they're not as excited about going to work every day, and, you know, not every day is easy. We all have struggles, and, you know, sometimes those meetings, they're tough, you know, and it can become exhausting. But if at the end of the day, you still don't think you have the best job, then I think you need to raise the bar on yourself and decide if this is the right fit for you. And I'm sure that it is. And the reason why I'm saying that is, you know, I've often raised the bar with myself when I started to feel like, oh, I've, you know, something just didn't feel right. But I knew I loved my community and I knew I loved what I was doing. So that's where I really raised my own bar and became more involved on the state and national level. And once I did that, the raising the bar for what you expect of yourself and your organization and your community completely changed. And I can't say enough about that. Making sure that you are exposing yourself to different people, different departments, different parts of the country. Your town may be big or small, you may be a different form of government, but we are still doing all the same things for best practices. And no matter where you live, people are people and they want to recreate. And I think for me, that I would encourage young professionals or professionals, no matter where they are in their career, they should always be raising their personal bar, because once you raise your personal bar, the standards for your professional world automatically change.
Yes, I absolutely love what you have to say there about self-reflecting and being able to raise the bar for yourself first before you begin to think about how to do that for the rest of your organization or team. So thank you so much for that wisdom. Can you give us some resources or advice that you have for young professionals?
Oh, sure, sure. So so I started small, you know, trying to get involved just to meet people in the state. As I mentioned earlier, I had moved to Boston and I didn't know anyone when I moved here. So I became involved in our state association right away and just did small things, helping out with the annual conference, and did that for a few years. Then I took on a smaller role on the executive board. And so I was on the executive board here in Massachusetts for, I think, 17 or 18 years. In my last 4 years, I was in the executive leadership and you know, took on the president role and all of that. And all of that was fantastic. And as I did that through my career in Brookline, that really helped me to stay fresh in Brookline, because a lot of people would say, how could you stay somewhere for that long if you didn't, you know, become the director, or, you know, if you didn't see what your next step there would be. So being involved in the professional organization really helped me a lot. And then I really felt like I was starting to miss out on some of the other areas in career development that would help me should I ever try to look for an advancement, or should a job come up. So back in 2010, I went to director school with NRPA. And at that time, it was in Wheeling, West Virginia, out at Ogle Bay. So I did that. And I would highly recommend any of those programs. They were really unbelievable. And I would say that that's probably one of the advantages to our organization, is that there's so many different ways to get involved based on where your interest is. But the director school really launched me into a different level of understanding about how great our network of professionals are across the country. And I learned so much from the educational pieces, but I learned even more from the people and the friends that I met in those 2 summers where we spent a week together out at Ogle Bay. So once I did that, and I knew I'd be rotating off of the state association, I became involved with NRPA and I got involved in the network. So I would encourage anyone who's listening to be sure you're involved in the different networks through NRPA, and you'll get a lot of emails, and there's different opportunities to do free and paid for CEU sessions or calls and conference calls and webinars. But you can, it's something by choice. You can get involved as much or as little as your schedule allows, but the opportunity is there to find all of the resources. I know many of us oftentimes will say, oh, geez, my committee's asking for this, or my community wants that. And 9 times out of 10, if you go onto that NRPA network or connect, you're going to find somebody already built that RFP or has that policy or procedure or manual or has dealt with that issue. And it may be a community right next door, and it may be a community across the country. So I think that's how I have been able to, you know, stay involved. And I would recommend that to anyone, the importance of professional organizations, but not only being a member, to be an active member and engage at the level that you're able to at that particular time in your career.
Awesome. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for spending an hour of your time today and for sharing all of these insights and wisdom with professionals around the country who want to raise the bar in the field. All right, you guys, that was my interview with Melissa Petit. Please share this episode with your coworkers or friends if they'd be interested in the career in parks and recreation. Thank you so much for listening, and I will be back next week with another interview. I have a ton of interviews lined up, and I'm so excited to share them with you. So be sure to tune in every Tuesday morning for a new episode. Thanks so much.